Hi, I'm Roxy Manning.
And I'm Sarah Payton. We're the hosts of the Fierce Compassion podcast. In this episode of Fierce Compassion, we speak with Shilpa Jain, the former executive director of YES, who works with social change makers at the meeting point of internal, interpersonal, and systemic change.
Shilpa shares how her parents' deep commitment to nurturing community and maintaining connection with their Jain heritage in Chicago through weekly multifamily gatherings created a deep knowing that there is no self without each other that is a foundation for her work in building communities worldwide. Then we heard clear, doable strategies for growing and nurturing community ourselves.
With Shilpa, we experience a warm invitation to listen very deeply to one another. Along the way, we even receive some examples of the kinds of questions we can ask each other that take us out of surface-level conflicts and into the deeper waters of connection.
And in this particularly timely conversation, we talk about Dr. Martin Luther King Jr.'s inspiration to us to continue to see one another's humanity, even when it is so very hard. I was also deeply inspired as Shilpa talked about how the concept of fractals can guide our social change efforts, noting that what we practice at the small stage sets the stage for the large stage. Welcome to Fierce Compassion, the podcast that explores the power of compassion in creating an anti-racist society. I'm Roxy Manning.
And I'm Sarah Payton. We're delighted to be joined today by Shilpa Jain, the former executive director of YES, working with social change makers at the meeting point of internal, interpersonal, and systemic change. We'll hear more about how Jain's journey has been progressing since, including YES and after YES, and the community building that she's engaged with.
So Shilpa, welcome.
Thank you. It's such a delight to be here. Thank you for having me.
Oh, absolutely. Several people told us you've got to interview Shilpa, so I'm glad that it's finally happening. We start out every podcast with the same question for almost every guest, which is, how do you define self-compassion? What's the role that it's played in your work and your life?
Oh, wow. I mean, for me, self-compassion is kind of one of the central pillars of the work that I do. For me personally, I think it starts a lot with my own spiritual and cultural upbringing as a Jain, which is a small religious community of India. And I also grew up in Chicago in the suburbs with my parents and extended community that they built there. And so this idea of really taking care of ourselves and taking care of each other and that we're each a reflection of one another and that we are woven together, to me, is such a deep part of my own work and where I sort of root self-compassion. There is sort of no self without each other, you know, and so how to blend those and bring those together and recognize that, yeah, each of us is out here doing our best, trying to bring, you know, love and healing and connection in whatever we're doing, and how to really recognize that and bring softness and grace to one another. That's really what my work has tried to do throughout my life, as well as how I just have feel very rooted in that practice and those practices and that kind of way of being.
Well, here you are, obviously continuing on from YES, but let's kind of start with your origin story. Well, you touched it a little bit, but anything else you'd like to say about your origin story and about your movement to YES and what the heck is YES?
Sure. Happy to talk about all of that. Origin story. So like I said, I grew up in Chicago. My parents immigrated from India in the early 70s. And I really credit them being my first teachers of community building. I think first, my interest in social change and social justice came through the environment. I was really just passionate about caring for the earth and all of its littlest creatures, making sure that they had a place in this world. And then as that developed, it grew into human rights and feminism and racial justice and so many, and plurality and so many other kinds of conversations. As I went into college and then after, I started working really on radically rethinking education and recognizing how what and how we're learning actually is disconnecting us from ourselves, each other, from the earth, from our hands, from our intuition, indigenous knowledge systems, so many things. And so a lot of my work started to grow in my 20s through connecting with transformative education practices and building learning communities. And I did that through an organization called Shikshantar, which is a movement based in Udaipur, Rajasthan in India. So I was there for 10 years. And it was during that time, kind of a couple years into that journey, that I heard about YES. And I was very excited to see the materials. I just remember my brother who I was working with in Shikshantar had gone to South Africa to connect with Margaret Wheatley's work on life-affirming leadership. And so while he was there, he ended up meeting someone named Kumba Ture, who was connected to YES. And she said, "You have to come to the YES Jam." And he said, "Well, what is that?" She's like, "There's something, it's for like 18 to 30-year-olds. I can't really explain it, but it's really powerful." And he said, "Well, I'm a little outside of that age range, but my sister is there. And so maybe you can tell her about it." So he came back and he shared the materials with me. And I was just so moved because I hadn't seen anybody writing about or thinking about this connection between what's going on internally, how do we feel, who are we, what are our gifts, what are our challenges internally, what's going on interpersonally, how do we build relationships, especially across divides, race, class, gender, sexuality, nationality, religion, age, and systemically, what is that? What is the world we're trying to build? How do we connect the dots? How do we see each other as part of a whole? And what is that vision? And how do we participate and collaborate towards that? And so YES was writing about that and talking about that. And so I was like, wow, I just am so amazed by this organization. I want to go and participate in one of their programs. And so I applied for the World Youth Leadership Jam back in 2001 and was selected for the 2002 program. I went to that jam, and all of YES's programs, most of them are called jams. They're in the spirit of a musician's jam. So the idea that we're co-creators and co-learners and that we don't actually know what's going to come out. We listen to each other. We tune in to what's going on and add our voice, add our stories, add our perspectives, and then in the process, co-create something that is previously unimagined and greater than the sum of our parts. And so my first jam in 2002 was exactly that, like profound, deep, rich learning and healing, lifelong friendships. I'm still in touch with many of the people who were in that experience in 2002, and it's continued on. So I got more involved with YES. They invited me to become a facilitator. We use the term facilitant because we're actually participating and facilitating, which is also a really beautiful stretch of leadership and learning. And since then, about 10 years into that, I went and took on the role of ED after the founder, Ocean Robbins, who had founded the organization when he was 16, decided to step down after 20 years of service. So in 2011, I took that role on and then helped to try to grow this massive, beautiful, rich legacy, technology, learning space, community with all over the world with many, many, many partners. And so that's what I did. And that's what YES is really just co-creating powerful experiences of beloved community and inviting our whole selves there and working through challenging conflicts and challenging dynamics, but trusting that we actually have what we need in the space. And as we tune in and listen to each other and learn from each other, we can find our way through and live what we're trying to create in the world as well as collaborate towards it after the jam. So I said a lot. So
no, I'm loving it. Like I've been sitting here kind of, my mouth is going, oh, this is so, so, so intriguing. What's really coming to mind for me is that I could imagine that right now, especially in the times we're in, there are a lot of young folks who are listening to this call who might be wondering, how do I get involved? And it sounds like YES has a model of participatory leadership, perhaps, that would be really, really powerful. And I'm wondering, like, I have a sense of like the values around YES, but I don't actually have a sense of what would a jam look like? Like, if somebody were to apply to be in a jam, what actually happens?
What actually happens? Well, that's what's really one of the most beautiful things is that each jam has a unique team. So there's, for example, the Egypt jam, which will be made up of Egyptians from a cross-section of Egyptian society. And they are coming together to develop what that jam will be. All of the jams work on interpersonal and systemic transformation. But then each one has its own unique form and shape, or the Law and Social Change Jam is a different kind of experience, and a group of lawyers and legal advocates work on that one, or the Restoring Justice Jam is a group of people who are restorative justice practitioners and formerly incarcerated folks and other people in the justice system who are rethinking that particular body. So there's jams that are identity focused, like Asian Diaspora Jam or the Black Diaspora Jam. Right now, at this very moment, the first Men Raised as Men jam is happening. So identity-based, then there's geographically-based, like Egypt, New York City, North America, the Middle East leadership jam, so many different kind of regional configurations or place-based programs. And then there's ones that are like sector-based programs, so that bring together people who share a kind of field of work. And what happens is, as a person applies, they share in their questions, their struggles, their hopes, all of that into their application. And the group of leaders who are helping to hold that jam look through all of that, and they develop a flow, super draft tentative flow, that comes out of looking at what are the shared inquiries, what have we also learned over 25 years of jams. They started in 1999. So there's some really clear learnings about what really supports a community, which we're constantly evolving and learning more around the global community. And then they come together, and we start with a really powerful opening to allow people to slow down, to sink in. And then the rest of the jam is kind of this combination of the in-breath and out-breath. We come together as a group and delve into one of those shared inquiries, and then go off into a little bit of our choose your own adventure, self-organize, and then we come back together into another one of those shared inquiries and go back out. And that's how the jam goes. And so there's always a beginning, middle, and end to every program. But it's hard to describe in words, because it's much more of an embodied experience. So what's going to happen? I mean, if you were there, you'll probably learn a whole bunch about yourself. You'll probably get to make some really deep friendships and connections. You'll probably maybe get really deep insights in the work you're doing. You'll probably be very surprised about some of the other things that you weren't expecting, that those were going to be the things you were going to learn. But through the co-created synergy of the community, those are the things that come out and come through. And so, yeah, that's the best I can say. And all the information, all the invitations for jams are on the YES website. So you're super welcome. Anybody listening is super welcome to go check that out, yesworld.org. So
yeah, we'll definitely have a link to that in the show notes.
So there you were, being the director, leading, discovering, forging the most beautiful community connections and experiences. What led you to make a change?
Yeah, you know, I really believe that the health of organizations depends on fresh leadership and on different people coming in for different times to hold it. And I've just seen too many nonprofits kind of fall apart when the person who's been in leadership for a long time kind of reaches their edge, and then they have to leave abruptly, and then the community's kind of in shambles and people don't know what to do and they're burned out and, you know, all of that. And I was like, I made a promise to myself when I took on the role that I wasn't going to do that. I was going to, you know, as things were stable and strong, the organization was solid, the community was solid, that like at the high point is a good time to step out and transition and let someone else come in when I have a ton of energy to support them as they come on in. And you know, the other thing that I think happens in organizations, I also feel was starting to happen, was a lot of like upward delegation. So there's like a turning point where, like, even though I'm stepping out of leadership and encouraging the next wave of people, and, you know, we helped to grow like 25, 30 new jams while I was executive director all over the world. And I would like step out of it after a few years with the team, go ahead, carry on and step out. But then over some time, there becomes like this energy of like, well, let's upwardly delegate, you know, let's just return the, you know, the wisdom. We don't know what to do. So that kind of energy, I think, actually leads to stagnation. And so I was just starting to notice more of that. I'm like, I don't want to be the bottleneck. I don't want to be the person that's, you know, sort of just because I have all this experience, therefore the next wave of leadership doesn't step up and take their part, you know, forward. And, you know, it wasn't extreme, but I was like, I'm seeing the edges of that starting to grow. And so this is a good time. Everything is very strong and solid. This is a good time. And so I felt like that. And also for myself, it had been 11 years. And I was like, this is also a good time to just see what else is out there. You know, I felt like I really made the contribution I dreamed of as and more. You know, my hope was really to develop a whole wave of leaders around the world. And I worked with over 100 different leaders around the world to like grow jams and programs of all ages and backgrounds and all over the place. So that and COVID navigation and making it through and developing online jams and what those could look like for new folks and all different things. I'm like, we good. We did it. We good. You know, time for some fresh blood, fresh energy, fresh ideas, you know.
Mm. Since then, what's been calling you? What have you been discovering? What's your journey been like since then?
Yeah, since then, you know, there is no shortage of conflict in our world. So I've been actually turning my attention a lot to working on conflict with people, both like direct mediations as well as developing tools and toolkits and courses and different kinds of dimensions of that policy for people to like have something to anchor to. And, you know, honestly, the other side of conflict is community. So the more we have some experiences, how do we share our stories? How do we transform our listening? How do we slow down together? How do we play together? That in itself starts to create a different foundation from which conflict, which I really feel is inevitable. It's just the meeting point of differences, and differences will always come up. Like how we be with those differences is just all depends on the container we're creating and the kind of relationships we're building with each other in the other space and the other time. And so I work on kind of both sides of that, that community building, the team building, the relationship side, as well as like when direct conflicts have happened, how do we slow things down, open them up and begin to understand one another more. Yeah, so that's a lot of what I've been doing and working with different groups and organizations and individuals in that.
As I'm listening to you, I'm thinking about the importance of community for us to face what's coming down the pike right now. And I'm curious because so many people tell me they feel pretty disconnected from community. And I'm wondering, what would you say to people? How would you support people who, like, I was thinking, oh, jams, 26 to 30, darn, I'm not that age anymore, right? So if people are looking for community, and especially community as a form of resistance, what would you tell people to do?
Yeah. First, I wanted to say that you are welcome, Roxanne, to come to a jam. We have that age thing was a very long time ago. Now we have all multi-generational jams. So just in case anybody else was thinking that, no, you're most welcome. All ages are welcome. All backgrounds are welcome. All of that is shifted as we realized that age was another divide and we wanted to bridge that divide. And so, yeah, all that to say, though, that beyond jams, the first thing I want to say is that I really understand why people feel it's hard to build community. You know, a lot of our public spaces, a lot of the kind of opportunities that people used to have and time that people used to have has been sucked away either by just the workload of trying to make it in this world that is not very generous, particularly in the US context, and also just not really getting practiced, right? A lot of technology comes in our way, a lot of like, there's so much distraction to put us towards being a passive consumer rather than an active creator. I always like to empathize first and just say, like, I understand why it's hard. And like, nobody's bad or wrong or should feel shame because it's hard for them. It's so understandable. That said, when I left India and came to California, where I now live, to be with my partner, that was a really hard move. You know, I had a lot of community and I had pretty much no community here. I had my partner and I had two very good friends and that was it. And so I made a promise to myself that I would go to events or things that interested me. And my goal would be to just meet one person, you know, under promise, over deliver. So just meet one person who I could invite over to my home for tea. And that for me was like just how I began the process of like, community is built, one relationship, one connection. Some of those connections were beautiful and we just continue to be in each other's lives. And some of them were just lovely for that one time. And that was also okay. But in the process of sort of realizing that it is something that we can build and I can build and be a part of. And then more people, as I meet them, we can build together. That's what really helps me. You know, it's just that it takes effort and it does pay off. Like I remember after a couple of years of having moved here, a friend was coming from Brazil. Somebody called me from Sacramento. They were like, can we do something here? And I was like, let me just call a few people in Oakland and da, 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 da. 15 minutes, it was organized. And I was like, wow, I've really arrived here. I've really built relationships here. And that was really powerful to me, you know, just like seeking out and putting the effort forward and also allowing myself to receive the connections. The last thing I'll say is that a few friends and I, realizing that one of the biggest challenges to community is scheduling sometimes, just like having that. A few friends and I in 2010, one of whom was another jammer, we decided to launch something called Communa Tuesday. And it came out of the spirit of what I actually grew up with as a child, which is that every weekend, because my parents were so committed for us to have Rajasthani community around us to be able to speak Hindi and have food and culture, every single weekend, we would either go to like a family's home or a bunch of families would come to our home. We call them parties. We'd have a party every weekend and it rotated houses. So nobody got burned down. This is around the Chicagoland area. So nobody got burned out. It rotated homes and it was every Friday or every Saturday or both, you know? So it was just a constant thing. And it was a rhythm by which we could define life, you know? And I have to largely credit my family for that because they knew what community was. You know, I think one of the challenges for a lot of Americans is that they never really had community to begin with. So it's hard to like create something that they didn't have an experience of maybe as a child. But that we can also still practice. We can also find teams and family, you know, friends to work with us on that. But so that was what we modeled Communa Tuesday after. So we have a group of folks just relaunched again post-pandemic. There's like 15 different hosts currently around the Bay, East Bay, who are willing to host. And every Tuesday night, we just come together, whoever is available, bring a dish of food to share, eat food together, be together without any other agenda rather than just being together and seeing what emerges. And it's really profound and very, very grounding. And I think that's something that definitely is needed in this moment, grounding presence of others.
So true. And what kind of links do you see between community and community building and compassion?
Oh, wow. Pretty much everything, Sarah. Yeah, what is not linked? I mean, I recently wrote a little article called The Compass of Compassion. And so I was just kind of inquiring more deeply into that for myself. And compassion, you know, from the Latin is to suffer with, right? And so the with part, being with each other. And, you know, just speaking to what you both were sharing just around, like, there's so much isolation. There's so many folks who feel alone. So the moment we come together, I know I'm not alone and other people around me know they're not alone. And whether we're suffering or joyful or whether we're somewhere in between, angry, exhausted, whatever we are, there's a space for each one of us. And that's what I think community offers. And so community to me is a reflection of compassion, right? And the more wide and the more deep and the more expansive I can feel that sense of community, my heart just grows exponentially, right? Every single person becomes more welcome in that community. I can feel that welcome expand. And that welcome, then I think that's the heart-to-heart compassion. That's the being with, being witness to each other, being witness to each other, particularly in these times when there's so much unknown and instability and also chaos and, you know, pain and suffering that's happening, as well as just still seeking out joy, still seeking out togetherness, still building that together. So yeah, to me, community and compassion definitely go hand in hand, and it's heart expansive. They're both very heart expansive.
There's a question that's coming to mind for me, and it's, as I hear you talk, it feels really lovely. And there's a sense of like communities, like you mentioned, when you arrived, going to things that interested you and meeting people who clearly like things that you're interested in and inviting them over, right? So part of my struggle right now is that our country is so divided. And when I think about trying to create community, I feel like it's going to be essential that we create community, not just with the people who think like I do, but people who don't. And so I'm actually curious around, what would you say about building community across identities, across political values and things like that? What are some of the strategies you've seen work?
I mean, I think it's all of that. For me, it's always like, I always want to invite people to start where it's easier and then get harder, you know, for you, whatever your edges are. Because sometimes if I try to start with what's really not that easy for me, then I never do it, right? So I always say start with like where you can. But what's been really beautiful to me with something like Communa Tuesday is because it's so open, people keep adding their friends, adding other people, adding these connections. So I keep meeting people way outside of whatever I thought I was interested in, right? So the artists and the chefs and the healers and the activists and the lawyers and the mainstream, like corporate folks and tech folks and people who are in, you know, schools or people who are, you know, all of these different folks start to come together, because the more the invitation stays open, that to me is where like I can expand into other places and meet across divides, right? And then my hope and my wish always is like, how do we bridge more? You know, how can I extend more and let more people know they're welcome? And that's been very beautiful for me. I mean, the strategy is essentially start anywhere, follow it everywhere, right? Which is something Margaret Wheatley says, like, okay, let me start with where I can go, right? Maybe I don't feel safe or comfortable somewhere, so I don't need to force myself to do that. But maybe there's a degree or a place that I'm like, oh, that would be a little edgy for me. Let me go try that out and see how I feel there, and maybe allow myself to be touched and connected. And oh, maybe that's another little edge for me. And maybe I meet a friend there. Again, that like sort of one friend at a time approach has really, really helped me. And the thing is, it's not just me, right? If each of us is sort of doing our own little bit of that, I feel like we get the more opportunities to bridge. The thing that I feel like is happening right now in our world is that there's so much focus on the opinions and the identities of people that we don't get to see or hear their stories. We don't get to ask, like, well, what is your journey? We just hear the soundbite, right? And then we stop. Or we just see at the facial level, like, that's it. We see that. We see the skin. We see the gender expression. We see whatever. And that's where we decide that I know. I know what this person is about. I know. It's like I understand it again. Like, I get where it comes from. And I also know how limiting it is, because every time I think I've understood somebody or something, I'm always wrong. I'm always wrong. You know, like, they say something, they do something, they surprise me. It's happened to me over and over again in my life. And so now I'm just trying more and more to just stop trying to know and just be with and let things emerge and let the curiosity and the conversation reveal something. And I wish we could have more of that. I really want to keep inviting us to grow more and more of that.
It seems like you're using the word bridge in a very particular way. Am I catching that?
Well, I mean, I do definitely believe a bridge is built from both sides, right? It's not a one-way thing where I build all the one side and then I meet you there. No, it's like that willingness to listen, to share, to listen. I think build something between us. And that to me is the bridge, is like the place where we can both walk. We can both walk side by side, and we can both cross. And in crossing each other into each other's worlds, you know, the world that exists in each body and each being, there's a world, there's a universe. Can I welcome myself and welcome you into my universe? Can I welcome myself into yours? Can you welcome me? Can I welcome you? You know, all of that, those different ways of connecting. I think that's the bridge.
And so this takes me to a question, and similar to what Roxy said, but even more specific. So many people, you know, have the experience of, oh God, I have to go be with my family at some sort of holiday, birthday gathering. And so what can one person do in a family or a room or a situation where there's a sense of profound lack of shared reality?
Yeah. It's a really tough situation, you know? And I will never recommend to anybody to do something where they are like, I absolutely cannot do that. You know, like, we have to honor our own limits, each one of us. We have to honor our own boundaries, each one of us, right? And our own capacity. Maybe this time at this next family gathering, I'm like, I really don't have the capacity. I'm just going to keep it simple, you know, compliment people on their dresses and their clothes and like enjoy the food and have a drink and just relax, you know, because I'm, but maybe another time I have more capacity, you know, and I want to say, you know, I'd really love to hear your story. I'd really love to hear, you know, how are you feeling in this moment? I'd really love to just give you my gratitude for who you are. And I know in my own family, a little gratitude circle can completely shift the dynamic because I'm not trying to win or convince. I'm only just trying to appreciate what is. And the more I appreciate what is and let go of my expectation of what I want it to be, the more present I am and the more people feel that. I actually feel how my relationships with my family members change when I release expectations of what they should do, what they should think, what they should be doing, you know, all of that. And just be like, okay, this is who they are. And can I tap into that like deep well of compassion, of gratitude, of curiosity, wonder, you know, and forgiveness and gentleness. Because, you know, all of us out here, we're just trying. Nobody really knows, right? We're just trying. And so in those family situations, I say, like, maybe don't go for the whole hardest thing. I always say, start small. It's like, start with your little under promise, over deliver. Start with your smallest little step. And maybe that's just giving everybody you see a compliment, an appreciation. And that is enough, you know? Maybe it's just thinking of a beautiful question. I'd love to hear something that sits with you when you were young. You know, that came from you, from your childhood. I'd love to hear something you receive from your mom or dad that stays with you. You know, anything. But like when we get out of the head opinions and into the heart stories, everything changes. We cannot be the same, you know? So those are always my invitations. Like, keep it real and keep it simple, you know? Yeah, and keep it love. Why not?
I'm really kind of getting a picture of how you weave community around you, especially in kind of like personal life and like your, for instance, not professional community, but you were also a leader, an executive director. And I'm wondering about how did you, from a place of leadership, support building compassion, building community within your organization or within the groups you're serving now? You mentioned doing conflict resolution.
Yeah. Well, with everything, you know, for me, I think if compassion is like a foundational value and practice, like listening is the practice that goes along with that, you know? And so in the work I did as the director, what was really great is that we had this practice of jamming together and, you know, the sense of like the inner is connected to the interpersonal, is connected to the systemic. So how we be is as important as what we're doing. And so slowing down, starting every meeting with a grounding and opportunity to just come into our bodies, slow down, starting with check-ins, checking into like how each person is arriving, feeling what's alive for them that day. And then really leaving that space for if whatever needs to be shared so we could see each other fully as human beings and then turn to whatever task we had at hand, you know? And so if that task was organizing, that would be where we would go, you know, and continuing with that pace of like, now I recognize, oh, you're just recovering from the flu. Oh, your dad is sick right now, or this is what's going on, or that's, and we can just hold each other in that wholeness, you know? I really believe this thing around fractals, right? So what we're practicing at the small scale sets the pattern for the large scale. That's how Adrienne Marie Brown puts it. And I love that because it makes so much sense to me. If I want to create community that is compassionate, you know, connective, and able to work through conflict, which is inevitable, then I have to practice that in the small scale. So we practice that in our leadership teams and so on. When I'm doing that with folks who are in deep conflict, right, I often start with one-on-ones with each person in that group. It could be two people, four, whatever it is. And really just start with a deep practice of just listening to what, you know, start with the question of like, what do you see happening? What's happening here for you? And as they listen and as they share, beautiful reflection back, mirroring, I'm hearing you say, this is what's alive for you. I'm hearing this is what's going on. And then I ask them, you know, how is that impacting you? All of what you're seeing, how is it impacting you? And that's usually where the vulnerability kicks in, right? Because then we're like, there is an impact this is having. And when that can be recognized and seen, then a person doesn't have to defend it. They have a space. So yeah, that's, you know, that makes sense. I always remind myself, everyone makes sense to themselves, right? No one is like out here not making sense. Even our current leaders in DC, they make sense to themselves, you know, whether that's from a place of like heart or whether that's from a place of reactivity, it still makes sense to itself, right? It's just, it's inherently, internally coherent somehow. So if I can recognize that when people are in conflict, then there's a space to be able to put it down too. And so then I can ask and inquire into like, well, what do you want to learn? What are you curious about here? What would you wish that the other person would understand about you? What do you want to understand about this other person or people? And then I turn to like, what would healing and transformation look like? What's your role in that, you know? And so this like very slow, but gentle and genuine process to just recognize and then invite people in and take the time it needs. Yeah.
So how do you answer that question yourself? What are the different dimensions of healing and transformation that are important to you?
Oh, so many. But I really, you know, the more I work, I used to think inner, interpersonal, and systemic were like split evenly, 33%, 33%, 33%, you know, that's the way change happens. And the more I work with people, the more I realize like, it's actually like maybe like 60% is the inner work.
So interesting.
Like 20-30% is the interpersonal and like the 10% of the systemic. Because I've just seen a lot of movements, groups fall apart because they go right to the systemic. Like, this is what we're working on. This is our project. And there's nothing there to hold them either relationally or internally in terms of like their values or how they're experienced. So stuff falls apart. And often in very painful ways, you know? Yeah, how I hold healing and transformation is really giving that time and space to each spirit that's there and like recognizing that so much is going on inside each one of us. And that as we make that space internally to see and become more aware and bring that consciousness and our connection, it builds those connections out, you know, with each other. We see each other more deeply. We see each other as multidimensional beings, you know, that are existing through time and space, through lineages and future. There's a lot going on in every being. And so it stops being so scarce, you know? And I think that's where some of our struggle is right now. It's like, everything feels scarce. Time is scarce. People are scarce. We can't do, you know, and that just completely puts us in the amygdala, right? So the reactivity is strong. Then I'm taking a shortcut. I don't need to know your stories. I know who you are already just by looking at you. I know who you are by that one opinion you share about whatever topic there is, but I don't know. I don't know. And if I can get out of the scarcity and into the spaciousness and into the sense that we can create more space together, then in that spaciousness, those connections flow. In that spaciousness, the transformations happen. We're able to generate and connect and build the ideas and projects and efforts that we're trying to. So
I'm loving as I listen to you. You mentioned fractals. You know what we do at the small scale sets the stage for the last large scale. And I'm seeing this fractal about curiosity, that we can be curious about our inner work. We can be curious about the person in front of us. We can be curious about the person we're in conflict with, and that it's always setting the stage for a compassionate coming together.
Yes. Yeah. And, you know, a big teaching for me around that was when I encountered appreciative inquiry as a set of tools. I don't know if you all have talked about that on the show already, but it was a real eye-opening. I think it was probably one of my deepest personal shifts that happened, was a shift from critical analysis to appreciative inquiry.
Could you say a bit more about this? Because we haven't talked about it on the show, and I bet you everyone's interested.
Yeah. Well, you picked up on my thread of curiosity, and so I will say where that comes from. So, you know, I, like many people, I was trained really to break things apart, to find the problems, to find the fault, you know, and that was like my education, and try to pick apart ideas and be critical of things. And it's not a bad thing. I don't want to judge it, but it also doesn't leave me feeling powerful or effective. Just always kind of would end up feeling kind of depressed and a little bit paralyzed and righteous. which is not helpful for relationships, being righteous. You know, my partner and I, like, we can be right or we can be in a relationship. So let's choose, you know. So that was where my critical analysis was leading me. And in my work early on in India, we started with a very critical framework to, like, challenge the education system. This is colonial. This is, you know, this is just feeding this machine. This is destroying communities. This is and what we saw, my family and my friends there, we saw that it would just turn people off. They would get very defensive to, like, no, the system is really, this is what we have and this is what we have to stick with. Or they would just, like, be depressed. Like, well, what can we do? It's horrible. It's a mess. What do we do with that? And we realized, like, wow, this is not leading. You know, we can get into some great sparring little intellectual battles, but what is that leading to? And so we came across the work of appreciative inquiry, which is, there's a book, beautiful book written by David Cooperrider and Diana Whitney about it. But we came across it through the work of a woman named Bliss Brown, who was running a project called Imagine Chicago, because we grew up in Chicago. We're like, oh, what's happening in Chicago? And she basically said, like, using this framework, how do we build bridges in a divided city? Chicago, any of you know, is a very segregated, very divided city. And she was like, what do we do? How do we, like, connect and weave together the city? And she learned about this tool, which is all about asking questions that lead to stories that evoke positive energies of love, forgiveness, generosity, courage, vulnerability, you know, strength, whatever, and that you don't know the answers to and you want to learn. So they're genuinely curious. You have, like, genuine curiosity in them. So she evolved this methodology using that tool to build relationships all through the city of Chicago, and started with a lot with intergenerational interviews of having young people of diverse backgrounds interviewing older people of diverse backgrounds as a way for them to, like, do these appreciative interviews, co-interviewing each other and learning each other's stories and experiences. And it was super profound, led to an amazing, amazing, amazing things all over Chicago. But what we did is, like, in learning that, we're like, we got to shift our approach. And so instead of starting to talk with people about, you know, what was wrong and how the education system was bad, we're like, so what do you love about your city? Who are the people who inspire you here? What is something you want to learn that you never had a chance to learn? What is your passion or your talent or your thing that you would really love to share with other people here, if you could, you know? And getting into these conversations with folks and following the curiosity, and we'd watch people light up. They'd be so ready to, like, do something together, be so ready to find, you know, new partners, relationships. We built so many amazing things all through my work and my time in India through that process, because people were like, we're building. And then on the backside, you know, once you're, like, building, oh, we've experienced a beautiful street festival that we co-created. We could talk about globalization or something, like, oh, isn't this different from buying everything? Or isn't this different from, like, you know, being just made consumers and working with money or whatever? It could come, but it wasn't the starting point. The starting point was, like, what are we creating? Who are you? What makes you come alive? What do you love? What do you want to give your love to, you know? And that just energized people. And then it felt like the critical analysis became less and less important. What became more and more important was, like, building from our love. Yeah.
Mm. Earlier in the interview, you used the words beloved community. And here we are in a year where the Pentagon has been asked not to celebrate Martin Luther King Jr. Day. And I just wonder if you have anything to tell us about whether Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. has meant to you.
Oh, I mean, so much, right? I can't grow up in Chicago and in the U.S. and not think about Dr. King and all of his brilliant, brilliant teachings, you know? Yeah, I mean, one of the things that stands out to me most was, you know, I used to wear it on my back as part of our Amnesty International work in high school, which was, injustice anywhere is a threat to justice everywhere. And just this deep, deep sense, and, you know, wrote about our mutual interconnectivity. We are connected, you know? So as much as this story of separation, this like, we're not going to celebrate this, we're going to cancel this, whatever, Black History Month, Women's History Month, we're going to cancel everything. It doesn't matter. It's still, there's still a connection, right? Those are all sort of like these reactive cognitive fears that are being spoken and expressed. But like what Dr. King really was sharing is like, we are connected. That is a fundamental fact. And what affects one affects all of us. And therefore, it is worth it to show up. I mean, that's what I take it. It is worth it to show up every day, to show up in love with each and every person as much as I can, you know, to the best of my ability, wherever I can encounter it, because it is interconnected. It will feed the whole. And so we were just talking about fractals. I think Dr. King was one of the first social justice leaders to deeply name the fractal, you know, to deeply name the truth of interconnection. And of course, that's such an ancient indigenous and it's an ancient understanding, but like to articulate it in a framework of social justice and social change, I think is such a huge part of Dr. King's legacy. And to lead with love. To lead with love, you know, and to lead also, you know, I was just thinking about this recently that Dr. King, like Gandhi, had a tremendous, I mean, the forces of violence against them and their movements and their work were massive. You know, we're experiencing our own version of that right now. But one of the things that they did was I think that they held faith. I'm like emotional talking about, let me drink some water too. I'm losing my voice. Oh. I think one of the things that they did was they held faith in like humanity and the humanity of each person. Their actions and their movements were to inspire people into their deeper humanity rather than shame or blame them for not having. They were like, you can be the human that I know you are. You can be the soul spirit that I know you are. That's what I feel like their work was grounded in. And that work, I mean, that is huge right now. Like, can we even hold the possibility that MAGA folks, that even Trump or Elon, which we can't say, I don't know, where sometimes I'm like, are they really human? I'm not sure, but at least there are a lot of people, a lot more people than maybe I've been told, they actually do have a deeper humanity. They're actually something deeper in their humanity is still remains, and can they be inspired into that rather than shamed for what they're not? And I'm curious about that. I don't know what that looks like right now. Like, I don't know how to do that, but I do know that I learned that from Dr. King, from Gandhi, and from other leaders, around, you know, along the way, who are like, no, humans, we can do better. We can do better than this. So let's try it. I believe in you. I believe in you. I have faith in you. And that faith is like what I want to keep drawing into and calling upon.
You mentioned a couple of times, like the kind of massive pushback that Dr. King and Gandhi experienced. And I imagine that you're also might be experiencing pushback in your work in our current climate. And part of what we're hoping that this podcast will do will be kind of inspiring people to persevere. And so I'm curious, what kind of pushback have you been experiencing and how have you been responding to it?
Yeah, you know, there's a very strong pushback of the punitive system and mindset, right? Someone has to be wrong. Someone has to be right. That binary, that punitive. Someone has to be punished. Somebody has to be, you know, the victim. All those binaries, I think that's the pushback that I most get. Like, people can't be that complex. We can't have that much complexity. It needs to be simpler. And I, the work I try to stand for is actually, we are that complex. We are really complex. Every single one of us is really complex. And it makes it hard for sound bites. And it makes it hard for like quick slogans. It makes it hard for me to explain things in a pithy way because it's often not that quick, right? It's like tapping into something much deeper. So that's some of the pushback I get. Also, just like, I think another part of that is like, a lot of emphasis on the mind, right? The mind will solve what we need to do. And I don't feel what we're facing is actually something that the mind can solve. The mind can create all kinds of stories and things, but something when I tap into my heart or my gut or my whole body wisdom is like when I can actually find a connection and make meaning and make a different way forward, right? And so that's also kind of the pushback, because I think from the intellectual left, or like, you know, the soundbite driven right, whatever way, it's like, no, 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 that's too, they want it from here and I can't give it from them. I'm tapping in my head for this is an audio program, but I'm tapping on my head.
Yeah.
They want it from the head. And it's not for that for me. It's from the heart. It is like in the body. It is slowing down enough to check what's going on in our body. When we want to build bridges, when we want to work through conflict, we have to sit with hard emotion that's coming through our hearts. It's painful. There's so much grief. There is so much grief that I feel like our society could really give a lot more space for. And to stop judging the kind of grief that it is. Like 360, there is like a lot of grief that I don't know. I don't know. The American structures and frameworks we have around grief, you know, 3 days of bereavement leave when you lose a parent. I mean, it's insane. You know, in India, we have, my culture, we sit 12 days. 12 days, the family is not expecting to do anything when you have an elder. People just come and take care of you. They feed you. They cry with you, sit with you. And then you have another ceremony 3 months later. You have another ceremony a year later. You have another, just to honor, because it's so deep, our grief. Now, we have centuries of grief in the U.S., centuries from all sides. There's so much pain. And what do we sit with each other in that grief? How can we? Like, that's what I want to, when I think about the pushback is like, there's too many feelings. Let's have the solution. And I'm like, no. The only way through is by doing it and being with the grief and, you know, being also with the celebration, being also with the play. Like, we are complex beings. And so the more we can celebrate that complexity and honor the pain and the grief that each person is going through, I think we find our way to something else. I mean, that's my hope. And those are the kinds of folks I'm trying to support and connect with and be a participant in as well. Yeah.
Mm. Wow. Well, as we're coming to a close, I often take away the words that our podcast guests speak and just let them nourish me over months and months after an interview. And I can tell that there are things here that are just going to be very nourishing for me. So I'm so grateful that you're willing to come and be with us. But before we come to a close, I'd like to ask, are there any actions that you would love to invite our listeners to take?
Well, as this is the Fierce Compassion podcast, I'm going to invite our listeners to be fiercely compassionate. And it's hella hard in Oaklandism, you know, it's hella hard in this time to be fiercely compassionate. It's so much easier to just be pissed off or just be paralyzed or frozen or in terror. So again, so understandable, zero judgment for that. But like, to be fiercely compassionate means that I'm willing to ask for a story, means that I'm willing to recognize that even all of these things that I might find really challenging, really abhorrent even, like maybe there's a lot of grief piled up underneath that that has never been expressed and gotten a space. And so what might happen? And in my small way, I would invite anyone in your own small way, can you be a little sanctuary for folks? Can you be that for yourself? Can you give that to yourself and bring that gentleness to yourself? And if you're able to and you have a little bit more in your cup, can you extend that to another? We practice, we practice, we practice, and then we build what we live what we are seeking. We build it and we live it. That's my offering and my humble invitation to all of us.
I hope each of our listeners becomes curious about what it would be like for them to take you up on this invitation. Thank you.
Or takes nourishment from you if they're already doing it.
I know there are so yes. many doing it. And I think the other last thing I'll say is that we're never alone, right? I remember reading once in a book from Derek Jensen, he wrote like, every blade of grass, every tree, every insect, every bird, every animal, every being that exists in the natural world is part of this is moving towards this interdependence, is living this interdependence, is living this connection and love. And we can always be surrounded by that. Always remember that. And so that's what nourishes me when I feel, it's hard. It's been a hard day. It's been a hard week. It's been a hard few weeks. And we know there's more to come, but we're not alone. We're never alone.
Yeah. Well, thank you so much. Thank you for being with us. If you enjoyed this episode and are finding value in these conversations, please help us spread fierce compassion by taking a moment to share this episode with a friend and rate and review the podcast on your podcast app. This helps others find us and helps make sure these conversations reach everyone who might benefit.
If you would like to receive live one-on-one coaching from Sarah or me on a special episode of the podcast, or you want to find out more, follow the link in the show notes or visit our website. You can find our books, How to Have Anti-Racist Conversations and The Anti-Racist Heart, and learn about our podcast guests and new classes on our website, antiracistconversations.com.
And Roxy and I love teaching, and we're always offering new classes, courses, and other opportunities for learning in our own individual work. You can visit us at RoxanneManning.com and at SarahPayton.com to learn more about our individual offerings.
We hope to see you.